This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Scholars develop theories that help us understand complicated systems and relationships, and often they're purely intellectual. But English professor Laura Wright explores a theory that is also a way of life. She is a vegan who writes about what it means to explore the world through a vegan lens. Laura uses veganism as a frame of reference to consider agriculture, food policy, and even broader economic and political questions. She says that lens can reveal uncomfortable truths about power, oppression, and morality. Laura Wright is a professor of English at Western Carolina University, also the editor of Through a Vegan Lens, Textual Ethics and Lived Activism, and she joins me now. Laura, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's make sure we're on the same page. We know what vegan means. It means we're going to eat food that doesn't contain any animal byproducts or products, right? But
right.
You're using this in a much broader sense. Tell us more about that.
Right. So I'm using it sort of as a way of looking at text. So I'm an English professor, so I do a lot of work with text, particularly fiction. I teach novels. So I'm looking at the text that I read and I teach through the lens of somebody who is vegan, if that makes sense.
It does, but help us make more sense of that. What does that mean? How would that change our understanding of the text and maybe some of these broader questions that we're going to talk about?
Right. So I think I'm trying to think of a good example of a text. Well, I'll give you the one that I wrote about, which is a movie called Beatrice at Dinner, which came out, I believe, last year. I don't know if you've seen that one. Have you seen it?
Did not.
Okay. Well, there's a character in it who is an immigrant. She has come to the United States from Mexico, and she is also a vegan, and she gets invited to dinner sort of accidentally at this really, really wealthy house of a client. She's a massage therapist, and she ends up there, and the whole dinner is sort of taking place with this character who's a very sort of Trump-like character who goes to Africa and kills large animals. And her veganism is a presence in that film in a way that really interrogates his choices and the choices of all of these other people. And her veganism is also linked to her status as an immigrant and to the destruction of the land that she was forced to leave to come to the United States.
So we can understand, and this is interesting because really there are at least two different levels that that you're exploring
right
here. One is what it means to be the vegan in the room, right? Because
right.
there is an explicit but certainly implicit critique of everyone in the room who isn't, right? And you can't avoid
right.
that. You know, like if you do this and I don't, I'm doing it for moral reasons. What does that say about your morality? Even if I don't mean to have this argument, it's in the room.
Yeah, and that's definitely the case. I think if, you know, you're the person who has made this decision, you are, without meaning to, I think, very often calling other people's choices into question. And that, I think, makes people very uncomfortable. And I've had lots of conversations around that particular issue.
And the other question around veganism, too, is often it's criticized as being elitist, something that
yeah.
you have to have a certain privilege even to afford, and therefore, you know, something on the fringe for that very reason.
Right. And I think that, I mean, we could really also interrogate the reasons why it is something that is viewed as elitist. What does it say about our society that in order to eat healthfully, in order to eat food that is fresh and good for you, that you have to be more economically capable than other people. And I think that says a lot about the structure of our society.
And that, I think, gets to the second level of all of this, which is how, whether or not we're examining your personal moral choice about whether to eat meat or not, there are effects and there is an impact that is felt by all of us, by each of our choices, whether we thought about them or not. And so what does this reveal to us about these systems, about the way in which, you know, food production takes place and, you know, and food wholesaling and retailing? What does that tell us about our larger system?
Well, I think it says a lot about who is allowed access to good, healthful food, which is, you know, kind of what I was saying. I think also there is a real link between people who work in agriculture and who work in meat processing plants and being disenfranchised within the system as well. There's, you know, kind of a connection between poverty and that kind of labor, and then also what is accessible in terms of diet.
Right, and in production. I mean, we can talk about the loss of Amazon rainforests to provide pasture land for meat that gets eaten. This is all way out of my field of view. I don't see any of this. And in fact, I might even be able to satisfy myself by saying, well, mine doesn't come from the Amazon. Mine comes from 70 miles away, and I know the farmer who raised it, and I know how it was raised, right?
Right.
And that's something that you also take on, the fact that there are these justifications, and you sort of take them on frontally in this book. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so a couple of the essays. So this book is a collection of essays that came kind of from a monograph study that I did in 2015 called the Vegan Studies Project. And if I can just kind of trace that to get back to your question. So the book came about because a scholar in environmental lit had written a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education that was really critical of veganism, and I couldn't figure out why. And I decided to take the approach of looking at the sort of stereotypes that exist around veganism within our culture, and I looked very much at our society in the kind of wake of September 11th and what was happening with our society and also with our relationship with food. So that's kind of where the book came from. And then I wanted to edit a cluster of essays for a journal after that book came out. And when I put out the call for papers, I was overwhelmed by people who wanted to give me work where they were looking at various texts through this kind of vegan studies lens, is kind of what I call it. Also, other people call it vegan theory. So I ended up getting a book deal to publish those essays because the work, there was so much of it. And a couple of the essays, I think in particular, you're talking sort of about the local food culture that, you know, is really, really popular and hugely popular in Asheville, where I live, and in the western part of North Carolina. There is an essay in this collection by a woman named Catherine Kirkpatrick, who is at Appalachian State University, and she's sort of talking about the way that locavore culture sort of turns a blind eye to the politics of animal consumption and its focus on getting food locally, that it's still not really, that's also a really difficult thing for people to do, to have this access to local food. But also that locavore culture very often is not paying attention to the environmental impacts of animal agriculture as well. And the other one I was going to mention is there's an essay in here by a guy named Dee Gilson, who is writing about hipster culture, which is another thing that I'm really aware of in Asheville. No offense to all the hipsters who are probably listening, but he writes about the way that meat is such a part of that identity, that bacon is so kind of a code word for being a member of hipster culture. And so that's not necessarily the locavore stuff, but, you know, a couple of places where the sort of elitist or ideas that may seem elitist are sort of brushing up against this kind of vegan theory.
Well, I think it is part of the locavore culture, because one of the ways that it's taken back is that, you know, when it's not cool to be eating meat is to know that you're part of this larger sort of international industrial scheme that is doing so much damage to the earth and to our health. Then you say, but when I eat this bacon, I'm not doing that. Because I know that this has been a well-treated animal, it's been out in the pasture, and we didn't have to raise the rainforest to do it, nor did we have to ship it thousands of miles to get it here. And by the way, we didn't have to, you know, toxify the ground, you know, and or kill a lot of or harm a lot of processors to get it to my table.
Right. Exactly.
So that is a critique and sort of a bit of a tension in this argument. The other thing is there's kind of the converse of this. Is that it can be hard culturally for people in certain demographics to take on vegan culture, to push back against their own culture if it is and has been historically so deeply associated with meat and fried chicken and pork roast and all that, if I'm Southern. And that can be kind of a challenge, it would seem to me, to sort of make the leap and find veganism anything I could embrace.
Right, and I think that's a real, you know, that's one of the biggest issues around it. First of all, not knowing how to make food that doesn't sort of center around meat. And, you know, I grew up in Greensboro. My family is from this part of the state, Western North Carolina. And all the food that I grew up with was, you know, very much Southern kind of food that centered around meat. And so, you know, to learn how to eat differently in a society where pretty much all of our diet is centered around meat. I mean, the standard American diet is so heavily meat centric. To do that is really, really difficult if you don't know where to look or, you know, don't have the resources to kind of figure it out. And then also, yeah, it's you know, alienating to people in your life who have cooked for you or taken care of you, and, you know, to see you kind of do something that they don't really understand and that does feel like a rejection of the way that you have been taken care of your whole life. And I think my parents are in their 80s, and I still think they're sort of waiting for me to get over this phase in my life, as my dad says.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, of an essay by Natalie Dorfeld about Meatless Mondays that touches on some of these issues.
Right, yeah, and she talks a lot about, she taught a class where, an environmental literature class where she was, you know, trying to get the students to embrace some form of environmental activism, even on a very, very small level. And one of the things that she proposed was doing the Meatless Monday thing, which is, you know, just to not eat meat for one day. And she was sort of amazed at the pushback that she got from suggesting that. And of course, she didn't require it, but she, you know, put it out there as an option. And, you know, one of the ways that she was kind of pushed back against was from students in the class who were athletes who felt that they couldn't get enough protein or that they would be missing something essential in their diets if they weren't eating meat.
What about as a political movement organizing? Because it seems to me that one of the challenges here is that this really is a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not just signing a petition here. You're not just agreeing that there's something wrong with this war or whatever the cause might be, right? Mm-hmm. You actually have to change what you're doing in order to participate in a movement. Should this, if we're talking now about and changing the subject a little bit, talking about political action, if we wanted to see change.
Right. And I think a couple of things about that. Yeah, veganism on the one hand is not, you know, eating animal products, but it's also kind of an affront to the very society in which we live. It's requiring that one really consider choices in terms of everything that one purchases. And I think that's, you know, you're really questioning sort of the structure of your culture. And in terms of, you know, kind of making veganism a movement, I did a lot of research about, you know, people who are vegan and why they become vegan. And people do this for lots of different reasons, not necessarily just ethical ones, but also for religious reasons and for health reasons and various other things. Vegans tend to be non-joiners. That was one thing that I did discover about my people, if I can call us that. We don't tend to want to be in clubs or groups. So I think, you know, having a movement is not something that I think many vegans think about, or at least the ones that I know. It's much more of a kind of individual decision. It's nice to know other people who've made that decision, because it can be really lonely out in the world.
Well, but it also points to, I think, the underpinning and the foundation of these essays and what mm-hmm. you're getting at here, which is we're talking about a foundation here. If you want to understand why racism is what it is, if you want to understand why sexism is what it is, and homophobia and Islamophobia and all of the things we would like to address as separate issues, you have to look at our political economy, which is the engine for all of it. And then if you want to really do anything about it, you have to stop participating in that. That means canceling a lot of canceling your Amazon account, which nobody's going to do, right? I'm not going to give up my iPhone because But that is the you know, the pawn in the whole capitalist scheme. So you can give that up. But that's what I'm getting at. Veganism is a way of life. It's not just signing a petition.
Right. It is, and it's I think an important way of life, and I also think it's a way of life that is, you know, very easy to make fun of and very easy to kind of vilify, which is, you know, part of why I wanted to do this work in the first place, was to sort of look at why that's the case. You know, what is it that is so confrontational about this choice? And also then to say, you know, what if you looked at the world from the perspective of somebody who is really thinking about the interconnections between a lot of the things that you just said, for example, sexism and racism, and our treatment of the planet and of the animals that we share this space with. So yeah, it is, it's something that kind of gets at the foundation of all of these other kinds of oppressions that exist all around us.
And getting back to what you said right at the very beginning, this is about text, and you talked about the way in which we use the terminology and the way we create these hierarchies of privilege. And when we refer to someone as an animal, as our president so often does, that means, you know, we know how they think about these hierarchies.
Right. And there's actually a chapter in the book by a woman named Carol Adams, who is a really foundational scholar in terms of connecting consumption of animals and mistreatment of women. She wrote a book called The Sexual Politics of Meat that came out in 1991. And it's kind of the Bible of of all of this stuff. But she talks, her essay is actually about the sort of sexual politics of meat in the Trump era. And she really looks at the way that he talks about women and the way that he, you know, compares them to dogs and calls immigrants animals and all of these other things. And that rhetoric is really, you know, dangerous. It's the that's how you think of other beings, other people as being less than you, is because we think of animals as less than us. And so if we didn't do that, then, you know, maybe we wouldn't think of other people as being less than us either.
Laura Wright is the editor of Through a Vegan Studies Lens, Textual Ethics and Lived Activism, also a professor of English at Western Carolina University. Laura, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org, and sign up for our newsletter to get a daily preview of our lineup. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio's broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.